This is Fronteras, a changing America. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up during this hour, we're going to be speaking with the candidates for the 2nd Congressional District. In our second half hour, the Democrat, Evelyn Madrid Earhart. And during this half hour, Congressman Steve Pierce. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us.
Always nice talking to you.
It's great to have you here today. And we're going to begin with a question that's open to you. Your most pressing reason, the reason that you ran for re-election.
I'm afraid for the future of the country. It's that plain and simple. The economic future is in doubt for the entire world. We're facing economic uncertainty in every country. The debt, the deficit, the spending are all the problems that contribute to this economic uncertainty. My background just leads me to have the skill sets here. I majored in economics. I've worked my entire life with economic questions. My wife and I ran a small business. I ran the number end of that. Then one of the few in Congress to actually have served in combat, so I understand what we're asking our young men and women to do when we send them overseas into wars and into conflicts. So I think that background just almost demands that I offer my service. Whether or not the people take it, that's up to them. But I think it's essential that we have policymakers who have background in the issues that are the strongest problems for us.
Congressman, as you know, some have criticized the Citizens United decision, which they blame for putting more money into political ads this year. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's all it did in my book is level a playing field. The unions already had almost unlimited ability to pour money into races, and the Supreme Court said it's a matter of free speech. That doesn't say that I agree with the whole idea of money in elections. But I do agree that both sides should be able to participate equally, and before there was an imbalance.
Following up on that, do you think there's a need for campaign finance reform? If so, what would you like to see? And if not, why not?
Well, keep in mind that we just did campaign finance reform not very long ago, McCain-Feingold, and I think it has created absolute chaos. The first thing we should have is absolute transparency. Every donation, when it's received, should be received the light of day. I would also think that even the groups who are advertising, the external groups, they should have to declare who their contributors are. So transparency would be a big piece of it. There have been suggestions that maybe we would want to limit contributions from outside the districts, that we keep these campaigns with people inside the district. That's something that I think would bear a great deal of consideration. So, yes, I think that we can improve the system, and we absolutely should set about it.
A number of polls, national polls, peg the job approval rating for Congress in the low teens, some even in the single digits. Why do you think that Congress is so unpopular?
Well, first of all, you have to break that down, the whole idea that Congress is that unpopular. I think that's one measure. But another measure would be aggregating all of the approval ratings for congressmen across the country. Typically, people in polls think Congress is bad, but their congressman is good. That's the reason about 90% of sitting congressmen are elected in any given year, and that's been an average for decades. So people generally like their congressman, but they don't think the people next door are doing such a hot job. So I think that the one measure is the low approval rating, but another measure would be for us to actually aggregate and average those. I think you'd find an approval rating in the 55% range if you did that.
Of course, addressing your answer there, there were a number of incumbents that were ousted in 2010. Republicans were very successful in that cycle, including you. And you ousted an incumbent Democrat, Harry Teague. Why do you think Republicans were so successful a couple of years ago?
2010 was a wave election, and it was created almost entirely by the concerns of the Tea Party. The Tea Party was concerned about the debt, the deficit. They were concerned about Washington not addressing those. And so you saw the wave election. I don't know that the population is in the same mindset right now, but 2010 happened not because of Republicans, but because people that found themselves sort of out there in the Republican direction really stood up and said enough is enough. It was an important election. I think one that was a very loud message to Washington. I don't think Washington has listened, and so it'll be interesting on this cycle to see if we again find the population voting for people who say we're going to go and take care of the debt and the deficit. That's what drives the Tea Party, simply right there.
You had a chance to address this next question in a KRWG TV debate, and we thank you for participating in a debate with students from New Mexico State University. I wanted to give you another chance to talk about this because it certainly has been a big issue, and it will continue to be, I imagine. President Obama talked a lot about reducing partisanship during the 2008 election. Many believe that we're now more partisan than ever. How do you think that that can be changed, and what would you do to change that?
Now that we have just a little bit longer to address it, I can give a more thorough
That's right.
Answer.
You only had a minute during the debate.
60 seconds. That's pretty tight. I ask people that in our town halls, them the question. I said, okay, look, we across America, we elect people who look and act like us. We go to comfort. So I ask my audiences, when's the last time you as a Republican sat down with a Democrat or you as a Democrat sat down with a Republican to discuss these same issues that we had in the forum that that KRWG just had? And almost nobody on either side. So we as Americans are not talking to each other, and we elect people, and then we want them to be different. So the first thing is we as Americans should start talking. The second thing that we should do is absolutely insist that we start working across party lines. Since I represent an area that's 34% Republican, I practice that all the time because I need Democrats and independents to vote for me. I need two people for every Republican to vote for me. So we work constantly at opening those communication lines. So I think I have a responsibility. And thirdly, then I can point to circumstances where we're actually doing that. The women's forums that we're working, have a virtual women's forum. Republicans, Democrats, independents alike, just discussing the issues. I lay the ground rules down. We're not going to talk bad about either party. We're not going to talk bad about anybody in office. What we're here to do is discuss the future of the country. And the women get it, and they immediately start talking about the deeper things that affect us, the things that we come together on as a nation, not the things that divide us. And that's the discussion that we should be having.
Okay. Well, certainly a discussion you're going to be having and many representatives are going to be having over the next few months involves the economy. What, if anything, should Congress do to jumpstart the economy?
The keys are our tax policy and the regulatory policy. President Obama has said that our corporations are uncompetitive because of the highest tax rate on corporations in the world. He said that in the last two States of the Union message. So let's get to work on it. Secondly, is the regulatory environment that would kill jobs without achieving some objective. And we pointed many of those out in our jobs frontier as the Western Caucus chairman. We put a series of bills out that would address the over-regulations. Regulations have a very important thing. They're supposed to protect our air or water, the land that we live on. But when they choke off jobs with no benefit, that's when I think that America is badly served. So if we will work our reforms, I think our economy will start growing again. We'll start attracting the manufacturing base back in. We must convert back from a retail economy over to a mixture between retail and manufacturing. Manufacturing is where you create wealth. That's where you create the long-term careers. People are able to progress through from entry level up to CEO. And so manufacturing is where the nation really needs to be looking.
Okay. A big issue for manufacturing companies and really all companies and individuals is health care. Some Republicans want to repeal the federal health reform law, but keep some of its provisions that the insurance industry insists require a mandate for insurance coverage. They need those additional people paying for insurance in order to have some of the provisions in the health care law, such as allowing people to get affordable care if they have pre-existing conditions, allowing their children to stay on a health insurance policy until they're 26 years old. Your thoughts on this issue?
Yes. The Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, whichever you want to call it, is something that's hurting job creation in New Mexico and across the country. I've been into businesses here where they say they're actually going to cut the number of employees so they get down below the 50 cap. But then New Mexico businesses are being placed at an uncompetitive disadvantage because the White House is giving waivers to large international people with access to the White House, waivers to not even participate. And so New Mexico firms are disadvantaged. What I would do is repeal the thing and then start back with the provisions. I'd bring them on slower online. We could talk about ways to do that. But I would say that the age 26 on your parents' insurance would be good. Preventive medicine would be very good. Tort reform is absolutely essential. The lawsuit abuse that's occurring in the medical field is something that drives costs up for everyone. Portability, you should own the policy, not your employer. You should be able to carry that policy with you. When your employer owns it, you're sort of tied to them if you've got medical conditions. And so if you own the policy, now you got more freedom to move to better jobs. I would also have shopping across state lines. The health savings accounts would be the piece that I would use to draw the younger buyers back in. What they do is they look at the cost of insurance and say, wait, we're healthy. Why would we pay $700 a month for insurance? We'll just take our chances. If we gave them stimulation, positive stimulation with health savings accounts where they could put the money in and use 70% to move roll into the savings account for them, if they don't use their medical services during that year, I think you'll see the young people come flying back into the programs. What they're saying is that if you're going to charge me $700 a month, I'll just take my chances. So I think there are many things that we can do that would address the rising cost of health care and the rising cost of health insurance, and we should be doing them. But I don't think the government takeover is the answer.
You mentioned health savings accounts. Is that then the way that in a plan you would support we could keep the provisions, is that the individuals would have to pay more, or would you continue to support the mandate that everyone have insurance in the federal law?
I'm deeply concerned when a government can tell us what we must and must not buy. I think it was one of the worst decisions of the Supreme Court ever to come out. I think it is right alongside the Dred Scott decision, which said, you can keep those people in the circumstance they're in. And so a government that can mandate the buying of insurance can mandate almost anything. And what our Supreme Court says, if you just call it a tax, then it's legal. I think that was a very frightening move on their part, and one that the Americans should be standing up asking deep questions about.
Of course, the Supreme Court is involved in many, many issues, including Roe versus Wade. Mitt Romney, as you know, announced his position on abortion rights differs from the GOP platform in that he makes exceptions for incest, rape, and the life of the mother. What is your position?
I respect his position. Mine is probably more restrictive, because in the past I've seen the potential for those definitions to be used to just open doors. In other words, they're used as excuses. If they were tightly looked at, tightly controlled, I think every single one of us could say, okay, there could be exceptions, but not when those are used to just start floodgating abortions through loopholes. So the application is how you get it to be exact and to verify. So I think that's the question.
And how would you verify?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, how do you verify that it was actual rape or incest? How do you verify those things? Very difficult, which leads me to say, until we can prove up, I would rather take the chance on the side of life, not on the chance of the side of abortion. I think that the whole life issue is a constitutional issue. Our founding fathers declared the principle in the Declaration, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And no one, the Supreme Court back in the 70s, when they declared the Roe versus Wade, when they made that decision, they said they were uncertain on when life started. There's almost no dispute in the scientific community. It starts on the day of fertilization. Unless on that day, unless there is something dramatic that stops the process, you have a 9-month process of life forming that results in the actual birth of the newborn. But it's life on day one, and therefore I think we have a constitutional requirement to stand up for it.
Okay. We want to move now to foreign policy. With limited time, I'd like to get to a wide variety of issues today. As you know, there's been a lot of saber-rattling in Congress about Iran, and that the U.S. will ensure Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. This scares a lot of people who believe we could end up in another war. Tell me your thoughts about foreign policy, particularly when it is appropriate to go to war.
It's inappropriate when our lives and our properties have been struck. That's, I think, the definition. So the people who worry about us doing something to stop a strike coming from Iran, I would point out that we did nothing to provoke 9/11. Almost 3,000 lives, a couple of $1 trillion of damage to our economy, all in one day, in two strikes. I think that that we absolutely have to be concerned that that outside forces will come in and disrupt our way of life, and I think we have a right to protect ourselves. I agreed with the President Bush on the war on terror. I think that his initial statements that here are objectives, we're going to uproot the training camps because they were sitting there training thousands of people to come over and do what was done. Uproot the training camps. We're going to choke off the funding that is coming back from the free world into these nations to fund the terrorism. And thirdly, we're going to take the fight to them. I think those were objectives that he met. You could agree or disagree on other propositions of the war, but the fact that we haven't had any strikes since then is something that you can't argue with.
You say you agreed with President Bush's war on terror. Getting to the question that I just asked, did you also agree with his decision to go to war against Iraq?
Yes. Again, I feel like that there were enough instances to say that Al-Qaeda, Taliban, whatever element of the terrorists are there. I think that when we started fighting terrorism in general, it pulled the terrorist fighters into that battlefield. I think we kept the battlefield there rather than here. It's like a street fight. It doesn't matter which street you started on, the two gangs are going to show up there where the fight is going, and I think that proved up. We killed or captured a lot of the Taliban, a lot of the Al-Qaeda there in that battle. So you have to say, well, maybe they were there or they weren't there to start with. But certainly you can't argue with the fact that much of the leadership of Al-Qaeda was dispatched.
One final question on this. As you know, the justification for the war in Iraq involved the allegation that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which had not been proven after we went into Iraq. We now have the same situation in Iran, where there's a fear that they're developing nuclear weapons. Certainly there's some evidence that they have been working on this. But what's the bar? I mean, when do you decide we have got to go to war?
Yeah, that's a question that probably you and I can't deal with. It's a question for our military and our security analysts. I know that the Prime Minister of Israel is saying that they're going to approach very soon a threshold by which we can't stop them after that. I know that when they're enriching uranium, when they continue their enrichment process past that required for nuclear power plants, and that's about the 5% enrichment range, that everything beyond that has no purpose except the continued enrichment on towards the weapons. And so it alarms me what's going on. I think it will have the potential to destabilize the entire world. Again, you can look at South Korea or North Korea brandishing about Stability is one of the key things we're after. I don't think the whole world will ever be a democracy or a republic or anything like that, but I do look for stable countries, and so China is an example. I don't agree with their government, but they're also pretty stable, and so that's their business then.
Of course, it's always been a big issue in our region. It's now really on the national stage. Tell me your thoughts about immigration reform.
I think that that is much simpler than either party makes it out to be. I think that we, number one, have to secure the border. I think that's with technology and with people, not the fence. The second thing after securing the border is I think that we should reform legal immigration. We do a lot of immigration cases. We help people come here. And sometimes it would take 20 years to come here legally. I think that if that were reformed, people could take an answer. They could answer yes or no. But when there's no answer, then they simply say, well, we could go there, raise our family, and be back home before we get the answer. So reform legal immigration. And then finally, I would simply ask a simple question to everyone who's here illegally. Do you want to be a citizen? If the answer is yes, then we can't let you get to the front of the line by coming here illegally. That would encourage more people to follow you and come here illegally. So if it's yes, you want to be a citizen, then go back to your country, get in the back of the line, and make your way forward. That's fine. If you're here illegally and just want to work, don't want to become a citizen, then get out of the shadows, get on a work program, come and go. We should make it easier for workers to come and go when they're needed and to come here when they're not, go back home where their family is. I think if we did those simple steps that our immigration problem would begin to dissipate down to zero.
I want to do a follow-up to that that you had a chance to address, but again, it was only a minute in our debate on KRWG-TV. A specific issue for individuals who are here illegally, mm-hmm. but then have a child in the United States. The child is a legal citizen. The parent is not. And you were asked about whether or not then what will we do about the parents? What will we do?
I think the concern is that if we allow those children to be the citizens and to draw their extended families in, not just the parents, but extended families, which there are cases where people say that's happening, then the question is, at what point do we stop this? We're one of the few nations in the world that allow the birthright citizenship. Other nations have said, well, this is very difficult to, we can't control this. And so I think that we absolutely have to look at the issue.
So we should end the right of citizenship if you're born in the country?
That comes down to a constitutional question. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I'd be willing to listen to to our Supreme Court, give their opinions about it. But in the meantime, if we simply decided that that you don't get to exercise the rights of citizenship until you're of age of majority, 18, 21, whatever the country says, 16, I don't really care where we put the bar, that you can't that you can't be the part that pulls people into the country, I think that we must have a solution. I don't think we can continue just saying, okay, if you're born here, anybody can come in and live with you, whatever it is. We got several billion people in the world. At what point do we say we can't house and feed any more people? China, India, those are examples of nations about our size that are overwhelmed with population. They're above a billion. We're 300 million. I think that we shouldn't be asking ourselves, what's our end game?
Congressman Steve Pierce. Congressman, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate you answering the questions that we ask, both in our debate and in interviews.
All right, Fred, it's a good program. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you at home as well. Coming up next on Images, we have Democrat Evelyn Madrid Earhart.